Support for the Science Friday podcast comes from QuickBooks. If you work for yourself, try the new QuickBooks Self-Employed. It helps separate your business and personal expenses so you can quickly track what you spend for work and what you spend for yourself. Try QuickBooks Self-Employed and save up to 50% at tryselfemployed.com/Friday.
Support for this podcast comes from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering precision cancer treatment guided by advanced genomic testing through its new Centers for Advanced Individual Medicine. Every cancer, like every patient, is different. Advanced genomic testing can help our doctors understand each patient's cancer at the molecular level and may reveal treatment options that were not considered previously. Learn more about the promise of precision cancer treatment at cancercenter.com.
This is Science Friday. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, sitting in for Ira Flatow. Polio has nearly been eliminated worldwide. At its peak, the disease was infecting nearly 21,000 people every year in the U.S. And in 1988, polio transmission could still be found in more than 125 countries. But today, that number is down to just 3. Nigeria, which is on that short list, just marked 1 year of 0 cases. Here to tell us about that and other selected short subjects in science, as Ira likes to call it, is Brooke Baral. She writes the blog Our Modern Plagues and is a contributing editor at Popular Science here in New York City. Hello, Brooke.
Hi.
Good to see you. How did Nigeria do it? I mean, it can't be easy getting vaccinations to some of these places.
No, you're right. It's not easy. So I wrote about this last week, at the end of the last week, and I spoke with Tunji Funcho, who volunteers through the Rotary Club, which is one of many organizations that have sort of banded together to get rid of polio in Nigeria and also in the other remaining countries in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And he was telling me that he goes out in the field every month or so, and they have to go door to door in villages and towns to vaccinate the kids. They have to do this more than once because more than one vaccination is required. And it can be really difficult. You have to keep the vaccines cold that entire time through all of the steps.
Yeah.
You also have to, sometimes convince people that that is what they should be doing, is vaccinating their kids. And then in some parts of the country, like in the Northeast, there's some conflict going on. For example, that's where Boko Haram is active. So they actually have to sort of be on call and have vaccinating teams ready to go out. They have other people sort of on the ground there that will tell them and give them a coast is clear, safe to come in and vaccinate, come in now,
so
and they'll do that.
Can we say, Nigeria is polio-free?
Not yet. So it's been about a year since they had their last reported case. They still have some tissue samples that they still have to do some testing on, which will take place over the coming months. And then they have a couple more years where they have to remain polio-free, and they have to continue to vaccinate people as well through that time before the World Health Organization will put them on the certified list of all clear.
Okay, so your next story is completely crazy. I mean, listeners, we know Facebook is good for, tracking down your best friend from middle school, but it turns out it can also help with scientific discovery, Brooke.
Yeah. So I read about this actually at Smithsonian. A bunch of people covered this as well. So an amateur Brazilian botanist was on a hike a few years ago and snapped a photo of a plant, as you do when you're hiking. This plant was a sundew, which is this really cool-looking carnivorous plant. It has these sticky glands usually on its leaves, and that attracts insects. So this photo eventually got posted on Facebook, and then a plant scientist in Sao Paulo saw the pictures and realized it was a new species.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's really cool. Really cool.
Does this happen often these days, that people post something on social media and then scientists are like, whoa, new discovery?
Yeah, I don't know how often it happens in general. I do remember a story from maybe a year or two ago when an entomologist, I think, saw an insect on Flickr and had never seen that. That was a new species as well. So certainly it's something that I think, the more you look at these, the more people are posting photos and the more scientists are looking at them, the more chances of finding new discoveries that way.
Now, you wrote a lovely piece this week about ants.
Thank you.
Specifically, longhorn crazy ants.
Yeah.
Tell us about these guys.
Well, first, a couple weeks ago, I got obsessed with ants in my kitchen. So this actually ended up being kind of a personal story.
You're probably the only person who was excited about seeing ants in her kitchen.
Yeah, I got a little weirdly obsessed. I was taking pictures and kind of live tweeting what was going on. But the ants in my kitchen were carrying this piece of dog food up the wall. So I don't know. It was really, I work at home alone, so it was really exciting. part of my day. But then, so I ended up writing about that for The Last Word on Nothing, which is a science writing blog. And then this last week, just by coincidence, these researchers at the Weizmann Institute in Israel published on a different species. My species was pavement ants. So they published on the longhorn crazy ants, and they published this really neat paper exploring how those ants actually work together to carry big loads. And they were actually inspired by one of the scientists actually saw ants carrying cat food in his house, and that's how they started doing this. So lots of parallels out there. But they basically found that these ants, these are crazy ants, they walk in really erratic, crazy patterns, and they can carry these big loads together. And what the scientists did was video these in the wild carrying Cheerios and some other foods and other loads, and take a computer and number all of those ants and try and figure out the rules that they were going by to carry these things together, because it's really difficult, actually.
Yeah.
If you've carried a couch with someone before, it's difficult
to
communicate.
You're like, okay, now move back, now you go forward.
And they can't talk, right? They have their own complicated ways to communicate, of course. So they're carrying, what they found was that these big ants carrying the object would all sort of move together and go with the flow. They would sort of conform to one another's movements to carry it. But often they would start moving and not in the same direction that they needed to take this thing to their nest, because that was the goal. So every once in a while, they would observe an individual ant that did know back the way back to the nest, that would come in and kind of redirect the ants back in the right direction. And then after a few seconds, that ant would also sort of fall in line with the conformists and go off kind of in the wrong way. And they kept having these leader ants go in and keep readjusting until they got on the right path.
Now, is this right that this behavior is only seen in ants and humans?
Well, there are some other creatures too. It's pretty rare, this collaborative thing, but ants and humans are two examples. I don't know the whole list, but there are other animals out there that do that, but not too many.
And I also loved in the study that they don't like Cheerios as much as they like dog food.
Right. Yeah, they actually scented it. I think it was with the cat food. They scented it with the cat food to make sure that they, you know, really wanted that piece of food. The Cheerios were lighter and easier to carry.
Okay. So just to wrap us up, you also are going to tell us about a study that looked at how city living versus country living affects aggression levels. We know that, but it affects their aggression levels in sparrows.
Right, right. And in ways you wouldn't expect. So this was in Science Shots this week about sparrows. Yeah. I mean, it kind of is obvious when you think about different animals being more aggressive in the city. I feel that way sometimes when I'm riding the subway. But these sparrows are actually aggressive for reasons not that you would expect. It's not the density necessarily or like the lack of housing. They actually looked at the materials that the sparrows make nests out of and to see if that was affecting it. It actually ends up being food, but it's the excess of food that seems to be making them more aggressive.
The excess?
Yeah. So they don't It's a little speculative. They don't know why that actually is, but it might be that having more food, they're trying to protect it from other species getting at it because it's also attracting other birds. Or there might be something else. They're trying to defend their territory. It's not clear exactly what they're doing, but it does seem that the food is making these sparrows anyway more aggressive in urban environments compared to rural environments. More so than any other factor.
Does this apply to humans then? I mean, obviously we all want to go on vacation. It's the last day of July, right?
Yeah.
Hopefully most of you listening are indeed on your way somewhere nice. But these sparrows, it's not just because they need a vacation. It has to do with feeding, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, for us, I think it's more, totally unscientific. For me, it's the density usually that gets me more aggressive.
No joke. Okay, Brooke Burrell, she writes the blog Our Modern Plagues. She's a contributing editor at Popular Science here in New York. Thank you so much for being here, Brooke.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, next up, it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. This week, Twitter started taking down jokes that users reported as plagiarized. Crafting the perfect tweet with just 140 characters isn't easy, but for writers and comedians, it can also be serious business. Should we take Twitter plagiarism seriously, or should we just laugh it off? Here to tell us the good and the bad of this Twitter takedown is Luke O'Neill, a freelance journalist based in Boston. Hi, Luke.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Okay, so we got to start with a joke, right? What was the joke that started this off?
Well, the one that got the conversation going was from a writer in Los Angeles named Olga Lexell. And here's the joke. Your mileage may vary on whether or not it's a great one, but it's, saw someone spill their high-end juice cleanse all over the sidewalk, and now I know God is on my side.
Okay. So it doesn't have to be funny to be accused of plagiarism, then, is what you're saying.
Exactly. It's okay. I kind of wish that, you know, the tweet that kind of got this conversation going had been a little bit funnier. But nonetheless, here we are, and this is what we have to work with.
So what happened? Somebody posts this, and then Twitter says, okay, we're going to go after whoever reposted it?
Well, the way it works is that you have to report it yourself. So you're essentially using the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which a lot of people are probably most familiar with. If someone posts your photo, that's a common way that you can get it taken down off the site. And this has been in place with Twitter for a while now. But this wasn't even the first tweet that this has been done for. But this just seems to be the one that caught a lot of people's attention and got a lot of people writing articles about it this week.
So it doesn't matter if it's just a tweet, right? So it could be, it doesn't have to be a joke. It could be anything.
Right. Well, that's the thing. Nobody's really sure about this stuff. This is sort of new territory here, and it hasn't been legally proven yet whether or not you can actually copyright a tweet. It hasn't been tested in court yet. And legal opinions vary on whether or not it is a copyrightable thing.
But we could safely say that, like, the good thing about Twitter cracking down on these stolen jokes is, like, you know, plagiarism is wrong. But what's the bad thing?
Well, so there's arguments against it, not many of which I've been sympathetic to. One you often hear when people talk about this is people say, come on, it's just a tweet. And I guess, but the type of people that say that are usually not really people that are out there actually creating anything that anyone would want to read in the first place. Another thing that people say on the bad side is that of all the problems Twitter has, this seems to be a curious one for them to have focused on. People have been talking about the harassment problems on Twitter for a while now and how that's something that they need to really, you know, get under control. So I'm somewhat sympathetic to that argument, that this is a weird thing to sort of focus on, but when there's other things that could be, you know, time better spent on.
I mean, whether it's good or bad, I was fascinated by the fact that there's a comedian claiming that some of his tweet jokes were used by Conan O'Brien.
Well, that's another angle to this whole thing. The fact is that Twitter, you know, a lot of people don't take it seriously, but a lot of people really do, and for good reason. You know, a lot of comedians, like stand-up comedians and so on, will workshop material on Twitter. A lot of writers, like myself, will use it in order to test out ideas for articles we're going to write. And it's basically like an open mic night where you're workshopping material for whether or not it's funny or supposed to be interesting or poignant or something like that. But the problem comes in here. When there's these big accounts that exist solely to scrape other accounts for material, so you'll have these Twitter users with tens of thousands or even, you know, some of them with a million followers, and they just are constantly reposting other people's material, and that's annoying enough on its own to have your joke stolen by somebody. But then they can turn around and monetize their accounts. So they can, once you build up a big enough follower base, you can start selling ads and promoted tweets into your account.
Luke, we got to leave it there. I know we could keep going on the good and the bad. Luke O'Neill is a freelance journalist based in Boston. Okay, coming up, we're going to talk about how school discipline is changing. We'll be right back after this short break.
Support for this podcast comes from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering precision cancer treatment guided by advanced genomic testing through its new Centers for Advanced Individual Medicine. Every cancer, like every patient, is different. Advanced genomic testing can help our doctors understand each patient's cancer at the molecular level and may reveal treatment options that were not considered previously. Learn more about the promise of precision cancer treatment at cancercenter.com.
This is Science Friday. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, sitting in for Ira. Okay, now I want you to think back to when you were a teenager. Maybe that was 30 years ago, maybe 10, maybe you are a teen right now. Did you or your classmates ever get suspended? And if you were, did you come back to school reformed and ready to learn? Well, researchers are finding that blunt forms of punishment, like removing a kid from school, not only don't fix behavior problems, but also may contribute to the so-called school-to-prison pipeline. And they have found that Black and Latino students get suspended at higher rates. Joining me now to discuss how we discipline in American schools and why it might be changing are Russell Skiba. He's a professor of counseling and educational psychology and the director of the Equity Project at Indiana University. Hi, Dr. Skiba. I think he's there. And also joining me in the studio is Eddie Fergus. He's assistant professor of educational leadership and policy at New York University. Hi, Eddie.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And Yamanda Wright is a data scientist at the nonprofit Texas Appleseed in Austin. Hi, Yamanda.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Okay, if you want to join the conversation, please do. Our number is 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. Okay, Eddie, I'm going to call you Eddie. What's the typical way that schools these days discipline students?
Well, I think what we find is pretty typical in schools in terms of discipline is you have expulsion, which is a removal of kid where they are, for all intents and purposes, not allowed to come back. You have suspensions where there's usually a time frame that's allotted to that suspension, and it's an out-of-school suspension. So it's 3 days, 5 days, or so forth. And then you also have in-school suspensions, right? So it's the idea of removing kid, but it's removal within the school. So most schools have in-school suspension rooms, right? And other schools have developed other types of strategies for addressing behavioral issues that don't necessarily have to lead to a level of a suspension or an expulsion or even an in-school suspension.
But it's basically nipping in the bud, zero tolerance.
Exactly.
Okay, and Dr. Skiba, how effective are punishments like school suspension and expulsion? Do we see that that does solve problems? What does it do?
Well, the idea was that if we remove kids from school, if we have severe enough punishments, that it would be seen, that would do two things. One, that it would be a deterrent to other kids that would see that happening. And two, that we'd be, by removing the most disruptive kids, we'd be making the school safer for other kids. Studies by the American Psychological Association, the American APA, did a year-long intensive study of hundreds of studies, and basically found that neither of those things hold up. Schools that use school exclusion, suspension, and expulsion more actually have poorer levels of school climate, higher levels of dropout, and these are all controlling for demographics. And as far as deterrence, we see that kids who are suspended in late middle school, 4th through 6th grade, a number of studies have found that those kids are more likely to be referred to the office or more likely to be suspended by the time they hit middle school. And again, this is controlling for demographics and types of behavior they engaged in. So it seems to be these studies are showing that the zero tolerance philosophy, while it's intuitive, really hasn't panned out in practice.
Okay, so those were controlled for demographics. But Yamanda, you're in Texas. Which kids have you found are the most likely to be suspended? Is there a breakdown by students' race?
Yes, absolutely there is. So, for example, Texas Appleseed has been collecting data on these sort of disciplinary actions for a very long time for all of the many, many, many school districts in Texas. And across all those thousands of data points, one trend is consistently clear, and that's that Black and Latino students make up a majority of these interactions, with the office, with police officers in the school. They make up the majority of these exclusionary discipline subjects, and they are overrepresented in these outcomes. So in Texas, Black and Latino students make up about 12% and 50% of the population, respectively, and they make up about, anywhere from 30 to 40% for Black students and much higher than 50% for Latino students of these exclusionary discipline practices. Okay, so and of course, that's really problematic.
Uh-huh. So, Eddie, you know, hearing what Yamanda just said and also the fact that maybe it's not working, are we seeing schools across the country moving towards other discipline models, and what do those even look like?
And, you know, that they are moving. And I think one of the key things that we've realized and practitioners are realizing around the country is that we can't treat suspension or expulsion as an intervention in of itself, right? Because it does not deal with what a lot of behavior researchers have identified is we're not dealing with the function of the behavior. We're just dealing with the behavior. So if a kid acts out, if a kid uses a curse word, our gut reaction is we need to remove the kid.
Yeah.
But that doesn't deal with the function of why that kid was necessarily demonstrating a behavior. So what we're starting to see is schools that are taking on more progressive types of discipline strategies, meaning that, you know, rather than trying to react to directly to the behavior, we're going to deal with the function of the behavior. So you have strategies existing like restorative justice. You have positive behavior intervention services and other types of multi-tier supports that are now emerging and becoming more prominent throughout the country.
Russell, can you give us an example? Like, I want to know, like, what have you seen that has worked? Is there one situation that's coming to mind for you right now that you think is sort of emblematic of a better way of dealing discipline-wise?
Well, I'm not sure that we can say that there is, you know, one particular method that's going to solve all problems, because, you know, these issues are going to differ depending on whether we're talking about Washington State or Texas or Detroit or, you know, a medium-sized town. You know, the disparities in race that we see are really, and that Yamanda was talking about, are pretty universal. African-American students are about 3.5 times as likely to be suspended across the nation. But that will vary from place to place. Also, Latino disparities will vary. Sometimes we'll see underrepresentation at the elementary school, sometimes overrepresentation. But I think, as Eddie said, there are a number of approaches. One of the one of the promising approaches is simply building relationships that teachers who have better relationships with their kids are more likely to engage in disciplinary strategies that will work for those kids and be respected by those kids. Ann Gregory out of Rutgers University tested a procedure called My Teaching Partner, where teachers who were good at building those relationships with their kids mentored other teachers, and they found that there was a decrease in suspension and the beginnings of a reduction in disparities in those suspensions. Restorative practices also build upon those relationships rather than blaming the child and punishing the student. There is an investigation of what caused this. Sometimes one-on-one investigation and the victim and the disruptive student meet and talk. Other times it might be a restorative circle in which there is a whole group of students, perhaps even a teacher and parent involved.
Russell, I just want to stop you for a sec. We have I want to take Ken, a caller who's calling from San Antonio. Hi, Ken. You're on the line with Science Friday. It's Manoush here. Can you hear me? Oh, sorry. I think I went to Mitchell in Charlotte, North Carolina. Mitchell, hi. You're on the phone with Science Friday.
Hey, I've just graduated from high school a couple of years ago, and both my middle school and high school that I went to were both the sort of no tolerance, get suspended pretty easily for punishment kind of thing. And I was just wondering if there's been any data that has shown that this policy of kicking kids out of school has ever really worked, because what I've noticed is not only has it majority been blacks and Latinos that have been kicked out of school, but also it's been the kind of kids that have never really been that productive in class anyway. And it seemed to me to be the complete opposite logical decision to kick them out of class for doing wrong in class that they were already not performing well in. So my question is, has there ever been any evidence showing that this has worked?
Thanks so much, Mitchell. Amanda, I want to take that one to you. Have you ever seen zero tolerance work, or is this something that is just never going to do what we want it to do and never is going to meet kids where they are developmentally?
Well, I think the important answer to that, the most important part of that question is works for whom and for how long. Mm-hmm. In terms of just managing classroom behavior, it may work in the short term, but in terms of the student who's being kicked out and that student's long-term outcomes, we find that this kind of exclusionary discipline, these harsh punishments, do not have beneficial effects for that student. In fact, it's way more effective to have a more individualized discussion with the student and work through these programs like restorative justice to ensure that the behavior is corrected and the student has the resources to, you know, use alternative reactions in the next situation.
But I guess, Eddie, you know, what that makes me wonder is it sounds great, but do schools, especially public schools, have the resources for this? And what about the other, you know, when one kid's behavior disrupts an entire class and there's one teacher dealing with 30 kids?
And I think, on the resource side of the question, I think there's always it's a matter of what's the degree to which schools are able to address this issue. So, for example, restorative justice circles that Yamanda's describing, you know, there is a level of resource necessary to conduct those things, but in the long term, it's not something that's that requires a high degree of resourcing. But yet, there are other set of strategies that are much more labor intensive and require shifting a lot of the systems in schools that does require, you know, resources. I mean, we're seeing it as of late. You know, the mayor's leadership task force that I'm a part of, we just released a set of recommendations that the mayor has agreed to that requires, you know, it's going to require additional set of resources. And, you know, fortunately, there's partnership that are happening where, for example, the Brooklyn Community Foundation is bringing dollars to the table to assist in really trying to pilot what does it need to look like in schools and what are the manners in which we can be effective in actually doing these things. So the resources are definitely necessary to try to address behavioral issues that, honestly, practitioners are not always best equipped, meaning that the methods training that they may have received in their undergrad to become teachers did not necessarily involve how do you respond to behavioral challenges that kids are demonstrating.
I mean, Russell, if we don't do that, what are the consequences? If a kid keeps getting punished, how does it affect them?
Well, there are just I want to jump back to the previous question just
Please,
for a second,
yeah.
Because it's part of the myth that we have these like super disruptive kids and our schools are going to turn into chaos if we turn this over to other approaches, and no one is advocating for an approach where we just let disruptive kids run the school. This is really about the best method and the most effective way of distributing our resources. Suspension and expulsion under zero tolerance were used for a host of minor offenses, defiance, minor disruption. This is what actually, you know, the research has shown that it's been used more for. And so that's tremendously time-consuming. Each referral to the office takes between 12 and 25 mm-hmm. minutes, so it really takes a lot of time out. If there are preventive measures put in place, those things will actually, in the long term, save time because you're not going to be putting a lot of time into chasing after minor misbehavior, which really saves resources for dealing with the more serious issues. Mm. Then we can really focus on those kids that are the more serious and troublesome behaviors. To answer your second question, yes, there are serious consequences for kids. Suspension has been shown to be associated with lower academic engagement, lower achievement, higher rates of dropout, and eventually increased risk of involvement with the juvenile justice system.
I'm Anoush Zomorodi. You're listening to Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Just want to take another call. I'd like to go to Laura calling from Arlington. Hi there, Laura. You're on Science Friday.
Hi. Thank you so much. My question is, it's the definition often determines the problem. And when you were talking earlier, the discussants were talking about race and the percentage of Hispanics and Blacks that were overrepresented in the classroom disciplinary. And I'm wondering, as an economist, I always think of other factors such as socioeconomic status. And wonder if that has been considered as definitely interlinked with race and Laura, to be part of the solution.
Great. Laura, thank you so much. Amanda, do you want to take that one?
Sure. Socioeconomic status is definitely important, mainly through the type of school that children go to. So if you go to schools that are low-resource schools that are in low-opportunity areas, you are more likely to attend classrooms that have these a high amount of these exclusionary discipline practices. But we found that race is actually, in many cases, more predictive than socioeconomic status, simply because Black and Latino children are usually punished more often and more harshly for the same amount of misbehavior, the same level of misbehavior as white students. And
wow.
So that's why we tend to focus on race, but socioeconomic status is definitely another important factor.
Okay, so I want to specifically, before we, you know, we only have a few more minutes, but Eddie, specifically the school to prison pipeline, how does discipline in schools play into that?
Well, what we have found, and you know, I'm sure Amanda can speak to this as well. There's been various projects, particularly the Breaking School Rules report from the Justice Center, that has, you know, for me, I find as a pivotal report that highlights, you know, tracking 1 million kids in Texas and identify that, you know, the set of factors that were playing a disproportionate role in that school to prison pipeline, and we know it is being Black, it is being male, it's being a student of disabilities. And having a preponderance of effect in kids having an interaction with the juvenile justice system. So our concern is the degree to which, you know, the frequency to which kids are being exposed to discipline, what it does in terms of what Russell was describing in terms of the level of disengagement and continuous disengagement that kids are exposed to, leaves, you know, has the potential of leaving kids out of the context of positive school progress and having strong connections with the school, with developing an academic identity and so forth, that we're worried about what it actually does for kids in what they're left with in terms of doing. So that prison pipeline piece, that school to prison pipeline piece is a great concern for us.
I'm so sorry that we've run out of time. It's a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much to Russell Skiba, professor of counseling and educational psychology, the director of the Equity Project at Indiana University, Eddie Fergus, assistant professor of educational leadership and policy at NYU, and Amanda Wright, data scientist at the nonprofit Texas Appleseed in Austin. We will be right back after this short break. This is Science Friday. I'm Anoush Zamarodi, sitting in for Ira Flatow. If you're wondering who I am, I usually host a podcast for WNYC called Note to Self on Tech. I am so happy to be here for Ira while he takes a little break. And now we're going to talk about this curious connection between our brains and our guts. People with autism often have food allergies and sensitivities. Irritable bowel syndrome has been linked to anxiety and depression. And in recent years, a growing number of studies have suggested that the bacteria in the intestines, the microbiome, have mood-altering effects. Researchers tested how intestinal microbes shaped a mouse's response to early life stress, and the results were published this week in the journal Nature Communications. And Dr. Pramisol Berchik is a staff gastroenterologist and associate professor at McMaster University and lead author on the paper, and he is here with me now. Hello, Dr. Berchik.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so I need you to explain what you did to these poor mice in order to test this.
Well, we used a well-established model of early life stress, and this model is used commonly in psychiatric research. And we induce this early life stress by separating the newborn pups from their moms from day 3 to 21 for several hours every day. And then these mice in adulthood develop anxiety and depression-like behavior. And at the same time, they have abnormal reactivity to stress. So that means they have abnormal levels of stress hormones. And also their gut doesn't behave as in normal healthy individuals.
Mm-hmm. So you did this to both ordinary mice and mice without microbiomes, is that right?
That's correct. So we did several sets of experiments. In the first one, we used conventional mice, that means mice with normal complex microbiota, that means multiple bacteria in their gut. And we confirmed the previously observed phenomenon. That means these mice who are subjected to early life stress, then they have this abnormal behavior in adulthood. Then we did these experiments in germ-free mice. That means mice which are raised in absence of any bacteria. They live in sterile isolators. They have sterilized food and water. So when we assessed these mice, we found that they have also in adulthood high levels of stress hormones. Their gut didn't behave normally. But to our surprise, they didn't show any signs of anxiety or depression, which clearly suggests that the bacteria are required for the induction of this abnormal behavior.
I mean, I have to ask, how do you know if a mouse is anxious or depressed?
So there are several standard behavior tests which we used. Some of them are based on the aversion to light and conflict between this aversion to light and natural tendency of mice to explore. So, for example, if you put them in an apparatus which has two compartments, one of them, one of the part is bigger, the other one is smaller, the larger one is well illuminated. And if you place a mouse in the middle of this compartment, usually the mouse hides in this dark compartment and then slowly starts to explore. And the time which the mouse spends in the well-illuminated and bigger area is actually a measure of their exploratory behavior. So that means opposite to anxiety or depression.
So when you put the intestinal microbes into the mice who had no microbiomes, who were not anxious or depressed, then what happened?
When we transferred the regular bacteria into mice which were germ-free but were not subjected to this early life stress, these mice behave normally. And interestingly, these mice also maintain the same composition of bacteria as the donor mice. However, when we did the same experiments in mice who were previously subjected to maternal separation, their bacteria profiles changed. And suddenly these mice started behaving anxiously and depressed.
I mean, I have to say, I think I'm going to say what everybody who's listening to this is thinking. Does this mean that if I'm feeling depressed or anxious, that it has to do with my own gut bacteria?
Well, our results would suggest that maybe. However, we don't have any good data from humans in this regard. My personal guess is that maybe in a proportion of patients with psychiatric disorders like anxiety or depression, bacteria may play a role. But as I say, we don't have any cause-effect data from humans. On the other hand, we have already some hints. So there are studies which show that fermentation profile in the intestine, which are likely caused by bacteria, are different in patients with depression. And also two recent studies actually shown that bacteria profiles differ between patients with depression and healthy controls. And finally, there was a study performed 2 years ago in the UCLA, which demonstrated that a treatment with a mixture of probiotics can alter brain connectivity in healthy volunteers. So there is, even in humans, there is some evidence which would suggest that bacteria can modulate our behavior.
So probiotics, like, do you take probiotics, doctor?
Well, I like yogurt, so in this way I take probiotics. I don't take them for their health benefits. And actually, this is another problem with probiotics, because in the food, in the shelves, in the supermarkets, we find many yogurts or probiotic preparations, mm-hmm. and with many claims which are actually not well justified.
Hmm. So I know what I'm thinking right now is, like, if people should either lay off the Zoloft and go with probiotics or just live in a completely germ-free environment. None of those options.
Well, I would definitely advise against leaving the prescribed medication. So our study suggests that there may be other avenues maybe in treating patients with anxiety or depression. But as I say, these studies have to be confirmed and validated in humans. And with respect to living in germ-free environment, unfortunately, this will not happen.
No. So where do we go next then in terms of finding out whether intestinal bacteria could be affecting our brains? What are you most excited about looking forward to?
Well, we have already started a study together with our colleagues in psychiatry department here at McMaster to explore whether really bacteria are involved or are different in patients with major depression and generalized anxiety disorder. And for that, we would use not only to measure the composition of bacteria in these patients and healthy controls, but also use these bacteria to colonize germ-free mice, what is called notobiotic mouse models. And this will help us to understand whether there is really this cause-effect relationship and also study the underlying mechanisms.
That's absolutely fascinating. I'd like to thank you, Dr. Premisel Berichik, staff gastroenterologist and associate professor at McMaster University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me. Bye-bye.
Okay, so despite the name firefly, these insects are actually beetles. There are over 2,000 species of fireflies in the world. Okay, so you have, for example, your synchronous fireflies that light up the Great Smoky Mountains during their annual mating period. But you've also got other types of fireflies that don't give off a glow at all in adulthood. Why and how fireflies do or don't glow is getting better understood by scientists. A recent study in the Journal of the American Chemical Society looks at the chemical reaction that essentially lights a firefly's lantern. And joining me now to discuss how this new finding contributes to the study of fireflies is Sarah Sander. She's a postdoctoral associate in molecular biology and genetics at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, and she just finished her PhD at the University of Georgia. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. The other day, I have to admit, it was dusk. We were out in the country. I was with my kids, and they saw fireflies for the first time, and it was wondrous. How? And they said to me, Mom, why are they lighting up? How do they do that? And I'm ashamed to say I did not have an answer, but you're here now. So how should I have explained it to them?
So those fireflies that you saw out at dusk were probably using these flash signals that you saw as a mating signal. So you were looking probably at males signaling to females down on the vegetation. And when a female sees the specific flash that describes her species, she'll reply with a flash of her own.
Gotcha.
And okay. So that's likely what you were seeing.
And how they actually light up. Did this new finding on the chemical reaction that causes a firefly to glow, does that solve a mystery that people have been wondering about?
Yeah, so we've been interested in firefly light for many, many years. I mean, the foundational work goes back about 60 years, and then when the gene was for the luminescence was cloned in the 80s, we've been very interested in how this light is produced. And so this recent work is really interesting because it's filling in the gaps. We know the major players. So there's an enzyme called luciferase and a substrate, luciferin, and they react together in the presence of magnesium and energy and oxygen to make this light. But we don't really know the specific substeps in this reaction. And mm-hmm. So this finding is very exciting to try to piece together this reaction and how it works.
And how could it help you in other ways to understand them? Could it help you to understand how the firefly light evolved? What other ways will it sort of push you along in understanding them better?
Right. So I'm really interested in how firefly light has evolved, both the presence and absence of light, but also in light color. So as you said before, there's over 2,000 species worldwide, and they make different colors. So some are yellow, some are green, some are more orange. And we know from some studies that the actual sequence of the luciferase is involved in color changes. And so I'm also interested in how their eyes have evolved to see these different colors. And so this research on how the reaction works can really help inform studies of how light production relates to signal color in natural firefly populations.
And do these different colors of light serve different purposes? You mentioned mating a minute ago. Other stuff too?
Right. So we think it might have something to do with the environment. So if you're in a particular environment, say out at dusk in the woods, there's a lot of light around. It's reflecting off of leaves. So it's a very green background light. So you might want a yellow signal that contrasts with that ambient light so that your signal will be picked up by a female and you will get that mating opportunity. So we're sort of interested in pursuing how these light color changes happen evolutionarily and why.
I'm Anoush Zomorodi. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. So, Sarah, I just want to ask you, am I right in thinking that the lantern organ that fireflies have as larvae, it's different than the ones that they have as adults? Is that right?
That's true. So what you can do, what previous studies have shown, is that you can actually use a laser to ablate the light, so burn off the light on a larvae, allow that larva to undergo metamorphosis, and then it will emerge as an adult with a perfect adult light organ. And so they're very different structures that perhaps use the same genes, the luciferase and the using all these different components, but in a very different way. And so we're also interested in how this works.
I mean, is that what you're doing in your fun time, Sarah? You're lasering off bioluminescent organs? Or I'm dying to know, how did you get into this?
So I usually spend my time driving around the eastern U.S. with a net, a car full of tubes, and I'm trying to find many different species to measure their light color and look at the genes, so their luciferase gene and their opsin gene, which underlies their visual sensitivity, and see how these two genes have evolved together to let them see the different signal colors.
I mean, when we caught these fireflies on our fingers, they're oddly docile when they land. And they seem to not mind sort of crawling over a hand. But I want to know, like, you're the expert. What are your tips for spotting fireflies this summer? And is it okay to catch them?
It's definitely okay to catch them. One recommendation I would give is to, first of all, when you go out, don't turn on any lights. So fireflies are disturbed by lights. They're actually light pollution, we think, is a really big problem for natural firefly populations. So don't turn on any lights. Turn off your lights in your house if you can, or your outdoor lights, and you'll be able to see a lot more. And then when you catch them, make sure you don't have bug spray on your hands. That might be something that would help. And in terms of keeping them overnight, I know lots of people like to keep them in jars overnight. It's actually not the amount of air that they have that's the problem. It's the humidity. So if you put a little bit of apple in with them, like a little slice of apple, that'll keep them nice and happy. I've kept them in the lab for about 14 days with slices of apple. So.
No way. My 8-year-old is going to be so excited to hear this information. Okay, we're going to go for it this weekend. Thank you so much, Sarah Sander. She's a postdoctoral associate in molecular biology and genetics at Cornell University. Thank you, Sarah.
You're very welcome.
Did you know that different firefly species have different flash patterns? You can learn to speak firefly using SciFry's Nature Guide. Go to sciencefriday.com/fireflies. One last thing before we go this hour. A few weeks ago, we showed you a macroscope video about fluid dynamics and lollipops. And we asked the age-old question, how many licks does it take to finish off a lolly? Leif Ristroff from the NYU Applied Mathematics Lab told us.
We arrived at an estimate of 1,000 licks to get to the center of a lollipop.
But that was just an estimate based on theory and mathematical models, not yumminess. We wanted hard data, so we asked you, and over 100 of you responded, taking the time to lick a lollipop for us and record your observations, and no, 3 was not a valid answer. We had answers from 40 licks to 2,056, with a lot in the 500 to 1,000 range. And we learned that it's a harder question than it sounds. What exactly is the definition of a lick? How much of a role does tongue roughness or saliva juiciness play? Unfortunately, we're not going to settle this today, but if you want to help us design a better experiment, visit sciencefriday.com/lollipop experiment for more. Charles Berquist is Science Friday's director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intaglitalia. I just pronounced it incorrectly. I'm sorry, Chris. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our Sci Arts producer is Annie Minoff. Luke Groskin is our video producer. Our production assistant is Becky Fogel. Our intern is Ella Fetter. Rich Kim is our technical director. And Sarah Fishman is our engineer at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. And if you like us on Facebook and continue a week-long discussion on Twitter at SciFry. If you'd like to write us, send your letters to 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. I'm Anoush Zomorodi, the host of WNYC's tech podcast, Note to Self. On Twitter, we are at Note to Self. Ira Flatow will be back next week. Thank you so much for having me today. We are going